Hello, and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 43. Deus Vult. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. So last time, we discussed the Beyliks on the coast of western Anatolia, Karategin in Propontis, İlhan Bey on the southern shore of the Marmara, and most importantly of all, Çaka Bey in İzmir. We discussed how Emperor Alexios Komnenos sought to cut them down to size, just as Kılıç Arslan returned from the east. We ended with Kılıç Arslan turning on his father-in-law Çaka Bey, killing him on the shores of the Dardanelles shortly after marrying his daughter. This left Kılıç Arslan as the supreme power in western Anatolia, with Constantinople maintaining a tattered influence on the coasts. And today, we will discuss how this situation will unleash a new type of holy war and bring a new invader to Anatolia. Now, before we begin, I need to note that just like this is not a Byzantine history podcast, this is not a podcast on the history of the Crusades. If you are interested, there is, of course, the History of Byzantium podcast and another fantastic podcast called The History of the Crusades. This is, of course, a Turkish history podcast. And so we are going to focus on the Turkish story. And while the Crusades, of course, had a huge impact on Turkish history, Anatolia itself was sort of a side theater of the Crusades, and isn't a real focus of most of the histories. The high drama of the crusading era, of course, takes place in the Levant. So today, I'm not going to delve into all of the details of the origins of the Crusades. I'm just going to give a sort of basic overview of the origins and background, and we'll leave off with the Crusaders on the doorstep of the Turkish world. I'd also like to note that it is important to remember that much modern-day popular history in the West essentially minimizes or even cuts out the role of Byzantium to the Crusades. Even at the time, there was a great chasm of cultural and even religious difference between the Western Europeans, called the Latins or the Franks, and the Eastern Romans. And histories by the Western Europeans always tend to minimize the Byzantine contributions, a tendency that has continued down through the ages into the present day, where foundational Western historians like Edward Gibbon basically see the Eastern Roman Empire as a degenerated and corrupted state. They see themselves as the real inheritors of Rome, and the Byzantines, you know, the actual Romans, as nothing but a corrupted and orientalized offshoot. Indeed, the word Byzantine itself comes from this ideological characterization. In essence, a slur against the Eastern Roman Empire to rhetorically cut it off from Roman history, to claim that it wasn't really Roman. In a sense, all of this is a form of intra-Christian Orientalism, and it comes down to us today. In reality, Byzantium was far from a degenerated state, whatever that means, and was a central actor in the Crusades. In some senses, even the prime actor, as it was Alexios Komnenos who called for aid from the West in his attempt to drive the Turks out of Anatolia. This call would weave together with the socioeconomic and political factors in Western Europe to launch the Crusades. Now to begin. By the mid-1090s, the political situation in Turkish Anatolia seems to have largely stabilized after the two decades of upheaval following Manzikert. In eastern Anatolia, the various Turkish beyliks were solidifying and coming into their own. The Mengücekids were in control of Erzincan, the Saltukids in Erzurum, and the Artukids in the Cazirat. In central Anatolia, based in Amasya, the Danishmans were in control of Sivas and held a wide swath of central Anatolia. And in the west, of course, Kılıç Arslan had returned, and the Sultanate of Rum held İznik, Konya, and a wide swath of western and central Anatolia, bumping up against the lands of the Danishmans. And in central Anatolia, the Sultanate of Rum and the Danishmand Beylik were vying for control over Ankara and Kayseri. And as we discussed last time, in 1095 or 1096, Kılıç Arslan had ridden east to put the great city of Malatya to siege in an attempt to further increase his power in both Anatolia and in northern Syria. Indeed, the somewhat successful attempts of Alexios Komnenos to maintain Roman power on the coast of Anatolia had resulted in the destruction or weakening of smaller bays in the west, the Ilhans and the Karategins of the world. This, together with the fall of Çaka Bey, had left Kılıç Arslan as the supreme Turkish power in western Anatolia. Kılıç Arslan had then further expanded his power and now ruled most of western and even central Anatolia as the overlord of the other beys. And his power and prestige would likely only grow. So sitting there in Constantinople, Emperor Alexios Komnenos was facing a truly stark and grim reality in Anatolia. The two decades since Manzikert had seen the consolidation of Turkish power across what used to be the heartland of his empire. While he had had limited success on the coasts, the interior of the plateau was further out of his grasp than ever before. The Turks were not just roaming the countryside, they were setting up actual states, beyliks, and even a sultanate. And this is somewhat speculative, but I think that the reality of the permanence of Turkish rule was only now really dawning on Constantinople. They had seen steppe nomads before, Pechenegs, Kupchaks, Alans, and so on. But typically, these nomads basically stayed nomads, which meant that their rule was essentially ephemeral and limited. They could always, eventually, be driven out or forced to submit to the Roman Empire. But these Seljuk Turks were different. They were actually building states here, in the Anatolian heartland. They were partnering with the Greek and Armenian elites of Anatolia, who seemed more than happy to work with the newcomers. The Turks were taking over the former administration of the empire from the top down. Some Turks were even using Roman titles. They were here to stay. So something had to be done, but nothing could be done. After grievous losses at the hands of the Turks and the Normans, and following vicious and bloody rebellions of the Bulgarians and the Pechenegs, the Roman state simply lacked the ability to break these newly emerging Turkish states. Anatolia was lost, absent some outside force. Now it is important to remember that the idea of calling for aid from the West did not come to the emperor from nowhere. As we have seen over and over again in the narrative, Byzantium was already deeply reliant on Latin mercenary knights. Indeed, there are some indications that by the time of Alexios's reign, even the famed and fearsome Varangian Guard was no longer composed primarily of Scandinavian and Russian Vikings, but instead Latin knights from Western Europe. The Guard even had opened a recruiting office of a sort in London. Latin knights, heavily armored and on horseback, were fearsome, heavy cavalry warriors. Their charges, with lances drawn and shields up, could be truly formidable, even against the terrifying steppe horse archers. Their main drawback was that they were difficult to command and basically ran off to do whatever they wanted a lot of the time. Their highly developed sense of honor made them sometimes break out and charge when not ordered to, which could make them easy prey for the feigned retreat of the Turks, who of course did not mind retreating at all if it gave them an advantage. So the Empire had long used these mercenary knights, paying them in gold and even with tax estates to fight for Constantinople. This had started off as basically a heavy cavalry supplement to the imperial armies. But as the Empire weakened, the Western knights became more and more important. And then, after Manzikert and the destruction of the Balkan armies at the hands of the Normans, Constantinople basically lost the ability to raise proper imperial armies. Meanwhile, the rebellion of the Pechenegs and then their ultimate defeat cut off the other great source of Byzantine mercenary troops. And thus, even before Alexios's plea to the West, the Roman armies were already largely composed of Latin knights. Indeed, there were precedents that surely made Alexios think about the possible use for a larger Latin army. As we discussed last time, Latin knights were deployed to the Greek islands in the struggle with Chalcabae. Now there, they had been sort of a mixed bag. As so often happened, they had been provoked into a reckless charge and had sort of blown the fight for Chios. But at other points, they had been incredibly effective. In the early 1090s, Alexios used an army of 500 Latin mercenary knights to retake Izmit from the Sultanate of Rum. This likely happened after Ebul Kasım's departure or during the upheaval of Kılıç Arslan's return. This was absolutely critical to cementing imperial control over the coasts of Anatolia, as Izmit was an important seaport less than a day's ride from Constantinople. The Latin knights were also critical to the emperor's struggles with the smaller Turkish beys. They were a proven quantity. And on the other side, Alexios no doubt remembered that it was at the hands of the Latin knights that many of the empire's worst defeats had been inflicted. Roussel de Bayeux and his knights had devastated Anatolia after the catastrophe at Manzikert, and in the Balkans, it was the Latin knights of Robert Guiscard that had crushed his own army and inflicted a defeat almost as horrible as Manzikert on the Empire. But Alexios came to decide that there was simply no other choice. There was no other place from where the requisite troops could be summoned. It was the Latins or no one. And they could be a powerful force, provided that they could be controlled and guided and contained. This was, of course, a great gamble. No doubt, Alexios remembered that Roussel de Bayeux had fought for Byzantium before turning on the empire after Manzikert. There could be no assurances that in calling for aid, he was not inadvertently summoning a new enemy, maybe one who could destroy his own empire. And thus, Emperor Alexios Komnenos, with great reluctance, unwittingly unleashed upon the world a new type of holy war. As the Roman Sultan Kılıç Arslan campaigned in Anatolia, entrenching the rule of the Sultanate of Rum and preparing for a campaign in Malatya, as the civil war between Berkyoruk and Tutush raged in the heartlands of the great Seljuk Empire, in Constantinople, the emperor put pen to paper. In 1095, Alexios Komnenos dispatched to Pope Urban II in Rome one of the most important letters in human history. Carried west by emissaries of the emperor, Alexios's letter lamented the ravages of the Turks and the perilous state of the empire, and pleaded with the Pope to assist in raising a force to oppose the Turks. Now, unfortunately, Alexios's letter to the Pope has not survived, unless it has been lost somewhere deep in the Vatican archives. However, an earlier letter of Alexios sent to the Count of Flanders has survived. This earlier letter discusses the same themes, and most scholars presume it mirrors the letter sent to the Pope. So I'm going to read from it extensively. Alexios starts by saying, "I wish to make known to your prudence how the most sacred empire of the Greek Christians is being sorely distressed by the Pechenegs and the Turks, who daily ravage it and unintermittently seize its territories, and there is promiscuous slaughter and indescribable killing and derision of the Christians." Alexios then lays out in lurid detail what he claims to be the crimes of the Turks, sort of the classic list of medieval outrages. Boys being forcibly circumcised, with the blood flowing into baptismal fonts that are then defamed. Girls being raped in front of their family as their parents are forced to watch and sing obscene songs. Men and boys of all ages being sodomized, holy places being desecrated, and so on. So quite an exaggerated litany. Alexios then says, "And who does not lament over these things? Who has not compassion? Who is not horrified? Who does not pray? For almost the entire land, from Jerusalem to Greece, and the whole of Greece with its upper regions, which are Cappadocia Minor, Cappadocia Major, Phrygia, Bithynia, Lesser Phrygia, Pontus, Galatia, Lydia, Pamphylia, Isauria, Lycia, and the principal islands of Chios and Lesbos, and many other regions and islands which we cannot even enumerate, have already been invaded by them. And now, almost nothing remains but Constantinople, which they are threatening to snatch away from us very soon, unless the aid of God and the faithful Latin Christians should reach us speedily." Alexios then continues to entice the Latins with riches and rewards, and the glory of the city of Constantinople itself, reminding them that there are secular rewards as well as spiritual, saying in part, "Again, what shall I say of the infinite treasures of the nobles, when no one can estimate the treasure of the common merchants? What is contained in the treasure of the former emperors? I say for certain that no tongue can tell it, because not only the treasure of the emperors of Constantinople is there contained, but the treasure of all the Roman emperors has been brought thither and hidden in the palaces." Just as with the jihad, as much as the war may be for God, it does not lack its temporal rewards. And this stoking of the greed of the Latins would, of course, ultimately have devastating consequences for the empire. Alexios finally ends his letter by urging the Latins to "hasten, therefore, with your entire people, and fight with all your strength," and saying, "Therefore, lest you should lose the kingdom of the Christians, and what is greater, the Lord's sepulchre, act while you still have time, and then you will not have doom, but a reward in heaven. Amen." This letter, with its descriptions of both the supposed evil of the Turks and the great treasure of Constantinople, was of course designed for public consumption, to attract the sort of greedy, devout, adventurous, and aggressive Latin mercenary knight that Alexios needed. Indeed, the fact that letters were sent not just to the Count of Flanders and the Pope in Rome, but across the West, throughout the recruiting grounds, as you might say, on some level shows what Alexios' goal was here. Not really to launch a holy war to retake Jerusalem, but to raise an army to defend Constantinople and retake Anatolia. Indeed, mindful of the danger that the Latins could pose, Alexios did not actually intend to summon the great host that ultimately made its way east. Certainly, he was not actually interested in Jerusalem and the Holy Land. What he had in mind was basically a force of mercenary knights of the type that had fought for the empire in the past. He just wanted a relatively larger force. But it turns out that to the great surprise and indeed horror of Alexios, this plea for aid prompted not the relatively large skilled mercenary army that he wanted, but a truly massive host, motivated by religious zeal and dreams of foreign conquest. A great army, not aiming to aid the Emperor of the Romans in retaking Anatolia before returning home, but instead determined to march on Jerusalem itself and to conquer. See, the plea of Alexios had in fact opened up a Pandora's box, and the forces that were unleashed would eventually lead not just to a great invasion and the establishment of Latin Christian states in the Middle East, but would, ultimately, result in the fall of Constantinople itself and bring the Roman Empire to the very edge of destruction. But we'll get there eventually. To understand why Alexios' call unwittingly caused this reaction, we need to look at what was happening in the West. Politically, Western Europe was entering into the period that's often called the High Middle Ages. Basically what you picture when someone mentions the Middle Ages. Knights, castles, lords, serfs, and so on. Though, of course, remember that this view in your mind is probably not entirely historically accurate. The big story is that the collapse of Charlemagne's massive Carolingian Empire resulted in the fracturing of political authority into a variety of medieval political entities. The Holy Roman Emperor remained, of course, and he had great influence and power, but the empire was in no sense centrally administered. Rule was now in the hands of a web of local lords, princes, dukes, and so on. These political entities were extremely numerous and divided. Unlike the states of the Muslim world that we are much more familiar with on this podcast, or the Byzantine Empire, this political world was really defined by overlapping rights and claims. Various feudal lords, kings, princes, barons, bishops, free towns, guilds, orders, and so on, claiming certain rights against others. We should not think of a map with clear-cut lines, but rather a quilt made up of overlapping patches of fabric, layering on top of each other. A king might claim the right to rule a large swath of territory, but below him there were dukes and barons with their own claims to various patches of that territory, with their own subservient knights having other rights to the same territory. There were cities that might have other rights, and institutions of the church with their own rights. All of these overlapped with each other, and the various power centers would often have conflicting rights and claims, leading to conflict and war. And in this divided political world of conflicting rights and claims, a great conflict had come to arise between the secular political rulers and the central religious authority of Western Europe, the Pope in Rome. See, as these new secular political rulers arose after the collapse of the Carolingian Empire and began consolidating power, they started to claim the right to basically run large parts of the church apparatus in their territory. Rights to appoint bishops, to control certain revenue streams belonging to the church, and so on. And these new rulers were mostly able to get their way because the Catholic Church of the time was actually quite diffuse and decentralized. The Pope was really just the Bishop of Rome, the first among equals, not the ruler of a united and centralized church bureaucracy in a meaningful sense. Not at all what we picture when we think of the later power of the papacy. But this encroachment of the secular rulers on the church's power resulted in pushback from Rome, and what is called the papal reform movement. The drive to enforce the Pope's claim to be the supreme religious power in Europe, and to really create a powerful and truly centralized Catholic Church run from Rome. The Bishop of Rome would not just be the first among equals, but the supreme leader of the entirety of Christendom, above even emperors and kings. The infallible font of all spiritual and ultimately temporal power. as part of this project of papal reform, it was during this attempt to enforce papal power that the great schism between the Catholic and Orthodox churches arose. As Rome attempted to enforce its supreme religious power over the Patriarch in Constantinople, which was refused. Now, the real driver of this papal reform movement was the incredibly intelligent, cunning, and aggressive reforming Pope Gregory VII. Pope Gregory and his circle began this project of reforming and projecting church power when Gregory was a cardinal in the 1050s, and the reform movement really accelerated when his reign as pope began in 1073. Gregory would reign for almost a decade, constantly getting into fights with secular powers, in particular the Holy Roman Emperor, who he excommunicated 3 times. Gregory introduced clerical celibacy and rules against simony as ways to entrench his power and reform the church. Critically, he banned lay investiture, the right of secular rulers to appoint bishops. From now on, bishops would be appointed by Rome. Indeed, it was this rule that really led to his struggles with the Holy Roman Emperor and the other secular rulers. These conflicts with secular powers, of course, resulted in war and conflict, leading Gregory to think about how he could raise armies. Indeed, the idea of a crusade, of raising holy warriors to enforce both his authority and to uphold the power of the church, had already entered into the minds of Gregory and the circle of reformers in Rome. During his reign, Gregory considered both crusades against Al-Andalus and Jerusalem, just now coming under Seljuk rule. Ultimately, these never came to pass, of course, and Pope Gregory was succeeded by Urban II in 1088. Pope Urban had been part of Gregory's circle of reformers and was determined to continue in the path set out by his predecessor, to build and defend the power of the church in Rome. And it was to Urban that the messengers of Alexios Komnenos arrived, bearing with them the letter and the plea of the emperor in Constantinople. Pope Urban received the ambassadors at a great council of thousands of religious and secular notables held at the city of Piacenza in northern Italy between March 1st and 7th in 1095. Tellingly, this council was held as part of a grand tour of Italy and France being undertaken by the Pope as part of his assertion of papal power. In particular, the right of the Pope to invest bishops. The emissaries from Constantinople presented the plea of Alexios to the Pope and the gathered notables. Pope Urban II listened intently and then asked the assembled religious and secular attendees to heed the emperor's call. In all likelihood, however, the Pope was already entertaining the idea of assembling a holy army. As I said, this had been considered by his predecessor Pope Gregory as part of their shared and ongoing project of enforcing papal authority. By raising an army, not only would the Pope's prestige be vastly enhanced, but he could potentially direct the army against his enemies as part of the deal. Maybe take out the Normans in southern Italy, or bully the Holy Roman Emperor into making further concessions. And a diverse army, raised from across Europe, with multiple lords contributing troops and a host of volunteers of all ranks and classes, would depend on the Pope and the Roman Curia, not just for legitimacy, but in some sense, even for administration. Raising and ordaining a great holy army would be a great tool in Pope Urban's struggles to reform and strengthen the central institutions of the Catholic Church. And from the East, Emperor Alexios Komnenos had just given him an excellent excuse for such an army to be raised. And so, Pope Urban II mulled over the idea of a great holy army directed against the infidel Turks a crusade as he continued his tour of Italy and France. Urban crossed the Alps, traveling across France, still thinking of the potential advantages of this crusade. On November 17th, 1095, Urban held a great council of both clergy and laymen at Clermont, in the Rhône-Alpes region of France. Of course, the council was focused on expanding and enforcing papal authority. Topics discussed include simony and the papal investment of bishops. In short, the power of the Pope over the secular rulers. Finally, on the 10th day of the council, the 27th of November, 1095, Pope Urban II assembled the gathered clerical and lay attendees. So numerous was the crowd that there was no indoor space in Clermont that could contain them, and so the Pope ordered them to gather in a nearby field. There, Pope Urban II gave one of the most important speeches in human history. Pope Urban II began by adjuring the crowd to be not sheep, but shepherds, to uphold the true faith, and to be loyal servants of the Catholic Church, to keep the Church free and independent from the power of secular rulers. He then continued to say that it was this meddling in the affairs of the Church, of secular rulers interfering with the way of God, that had led the world into disorder. So far, so normal. But then the Pope continued and embarked on a new theme. Urban said that just as there had been disorder in the West due to the sins of men and the interference with the power of the Church, there had been an even greater disorder in the East. The chronicler, Fulcher of Chartres, who was actually there at Clermont, relates that Urban said, "Although, O sons of God, you have promised more firmly than ever to keep the peace among yourselves and to preserve the rights of the Church, there remains still an important work for you to do. Freshly quickened by the divine correction, you must apply the strength of your righteousness to another matter which concerns you as well as God. For your brethren, who live in the East, are in urgent need of your help, and you must hasten to give them the aid which has often been promised them. For, as the most of you have heard, the Turks and the Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of Romania, that is the Byzantine Empire, as far west as the shores of the Mediterranean and the Hellespont, which is called the Arm of St. George. They have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in battle 7 times. They have killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impurity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account I, or rather the Lord, beseech you, as Christ's heralds, to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It is meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it." The Pope then promised absolution from sin to those who would undertake this great holy war, saying, "All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God with which I am invested." Overcome with emotion and zeal, the attendees began to chant what would come to be the battle cry of the Crusaders: Deus vult, Latin for God wills it. Thus, the First Crusade was launched. According to the Gesta Francorum, an anonymous chronicle of the deeds of the Crusaders written by a common soldier on crusade in the service of the Crusader leader Bohemond, news of the call to march east spread rapidly throughout France and indeed beyond. Now as these words spread little by little through all the fatherland of Gaul, the Franks, hearing those words, began to sew the cross, without delay, on their right shoulders, declaring that they would, to a man, follow in the footsteps of Christ, by whom they had been ransomed from Tartarus. Thus great armies began to assemble, composed of both commoners and knights. Pope Urban had planned for the departure of the crusading army in August 1096, so about a year and a half after the speech at Clermont. The recruitment was truly a continent-wide effort, and some scholars estimate that ultimately 60 to 70,000 men would take the cross. They came from across the European social hierarchy, everyone from kings down to serfs. And this is ultimately due to an often overlooked cause of the Crusades, the demographic and indeed economic boom in Western Europe at this time. Due to a variety of factors, including a relatively wet and warm climate, the population of Western Europe began booming in the 11th century. We see archaeological evidence of great clearances as former forests and marshlands were turned into farmland. Indeed, certain regions of Europe, in particular parts of France, northern Italy, the Low Countries, and Germany, were likely among the most densely populated regions on the planet. This, of course, resulted in a surplus of people, meaning ample soldiers were available for foreign war, and many men were likely open to seeking outside opportunities in an increasingly cramped Europe. Now, the Pope had, of course, planned for a crusade led by the nobility, and these nobles would be the leaders of the coming crusade. The key leaders were Raymond of Saint-Gilles, a Provençal noble who assembled the first great army, a son of William the Conqueror named Robert Curthose, the French Godfrey of Bouillon, the Count of Flanders Robert II, a French count named Hugh the Great, and perhaps most important of them all, hailing from Taranto in southern Italy, the Norman Bohemund. These nobles were motivated by a variety of factors, including genuine religious zeal, a belief that victory in the East would give them legitimacy and status in their power struggles at home, a desire to get on the good side of the increasingly powerful papacy, and for some, such as Bohemund, the desire to set up their own kingdoms in the East. These noble-led contingents were mostly made up of knights, men with experience, who were also looking for glory, gold, and God in a campaign to the East. But in a harbinger of things to come, events quickly overtook the official leadership in Rome and these noble leaders, because the most successful early organizer of the First Crusade was a charismatic priest named Peter the Hermit. Peter the Hermit traveled throughout France, raising an army of untrained French and German peasants and other commoners, the so-called People's Crusade. According to Anna Comnena, Peter the Hermit had earlier traveled on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. There he had been harassed and persecuted by the Turks before he was able to return home with much difficulty. And in an omen of the differences that would soon arise between Constantinople and the Crusaders, Peter was preaching that the ultimate destination of this crusade was not Anatolia, but Jerusalem. And this was something that was not only true of the masses, but of the leadership of the crusade. Alexios had summoned them to fight the Turks in Anatolia, but as the call reverberated around Europe, the target shifted. Because what French or German or Italian peasant, or even knight, really cares about Anatolia? The holy city, recited in their prayers at church, was not Iznik or Konya or even Constantinople. It was Jerusalem. And thus, the armies that would come to march east were willing to aid the emperor to a point. Their real goal was not to be hired muscle for Alexios in his campaign to retake Anatolia, but rather to redeem Jerusalem, conquer the Holy Land, and for some, to set up their own principalities there. So led by Peter the Hermit, the People's Crusade began to march east in spring 1096, picking up untrained peasant recruits as they went along. Filled with holy zeal and fury against the infidel, they naturally also took the time to massacre several Jewish communities that happened to be on the way, including killing thousands of Jews in Mainz, Lorraine, and Cologne. Crossing Germany and marching down through the Balkans, they attracted further followers, men, women, and children alike. As they marched east and south, they stripped the land bare and faced deep fear and skepticism by the locals, most of whom were far from thrilled to find this large and chaotic army of zealous and hungry peasants on their doorstep. Anna Komnena writes of the coming of the Crusaders, "For the whole of the West and all the barbarian tribes which dwell between the further side of the Adriatic and the Pillars of Hercules had all migrated in a body and were marching into Asia through intervening Europe and were making the journey with all of their household." Anna Komnena adds darkly that this people's crusade of Western barbarians was preceded by locusts, an omen of what they would bring. Finally, in August 1096, this motley army came to Constantinople, deeply disturbing Emperor Alexios. No doubt, Alexios had been hearing reports of the raising of forces in Europe and had been getting increasingly distressed. And now, this army showing up on his doorstep was sort of the opposite of what he had wanted. Alexios had called for a relatively large, but still ultimately manageable, mercenary force of experienced, professional Latin knights to help him regain Anatolia. What he got was a truly massive and unruly host of untrained peasants who were led by a religious zealot priest and were speaking not of Anatolia, but of Jerusalem. So fantastic. And this would be the beginning of a tense and difficult relationship between Constantinople and the Crusaders. Alexios had called for aid, but he did not anticipate the type or size of the host he had summoned. And now he was desperate to keep these Western barbarians from pillaging his country and the great city of Constantinople. The new arrivals, this mass of unwashed and hungry peasants, were of course demanding supplies and lodging. They could easily turn to pillage if they became unhappy. And furthermore, Alexios had reports that real knights, led by the likes of Bohemond and Raymond and the two Roberts, were on the way. But these as well would be far larger forces than he had expected, and would also need provisions. And when these real knights finally got there, he would still need to find a way to control and corral them. No doubt, he feared what they might be able to do to the empire if they so chose. But that was a problem for tomorrow. In the immediate term, Alexios had to figure out what to do with this unruly people's crusade. On the one hand, he wanted them to be placed under commanders who could control them and maybe make them useful. But on the other hand, he just wanted them out of the way, somewhere not in the great city of Constantinople. And no doubt, Alexios knew that this mass of untrained peasants had no chance at all of defeating the Turks. Even if put under the command of real military commanders, these people were just going to become arrow fodder regardless. So maybe it was better to send them off now and get them away from Constantinople. The decision basically made itself as the People's Crusade flowed into Constantinople and its environs and behaved basically the way that any civilized Greek would expect of the Western barbarians. Even the Gesta Francorum reports, "The emperor had ordered that they be given supplies, as were readily available in the city, and he said to them, 'Do not cross over the Arm,' that is the Bosphorus, before the bulk of the Christians arrive, because you are not numerous enough to fight the Turks. However, these same Christians gave themselves over to wickedness, for they destroyed and burned the palaces of the city, and they removed the lead with which the roofs of churches were covered, and sold it to the Greeks. Emperor Alexios therefore decided to just get these people out of the capital. Indeed, the fools were eager to move on, supremely confident in their faith and completely ignorant of the power of the Turks. And so, Alexios arranged for transport and sent them over the Bosphorus. Thus, the first crusaders left Europe and arrived in Asia. And next time, we will discuss how this people's crusade would inaugurate the crusading era as the Sultanate of Rum musters for war.